Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with rockets fired from Gaza and airstrikes in response as 300 Palestinians are injured in clashes in Jerusalem around the third holiest shrine in Islam, the Al-Aqsa Mosque, following days of provocations from Israeli nationalists and settlers who plan to evict Palestinian families from their homes in the Sheikh Jarrah district of East Jerusalem. Joining us is Gideon Levy, an Israeli journalist and columnist for Haaretz and a member of its editorial board. He is the former spokesman for Shimon Peres and is the author of The Punishment of Gaza, who writes the weekly Twilight Zone feature on the West Bank occupation and Gaza, whose latest article is A Totally Right-Wing Government. We will discuss Israel's new government that is even further to the right than Netanyahu's was, and the growing political and economic weakness of the Palestinians compared to the growing strength of the Israelis. Then we'll look into the ransomware cyber attack on the critical infrastructure of Colonial Pipeline, which supplies 100 million gallons of fuel daily, amounting to 45% of the East Coast's supply of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Sean Lingus, a senior reporter at CyberScoop covering the Department of Homeland Security in Congress, joins us to discuss his latest article, Cyber Attack Disrupts Colonial Pipeline, which transports 100 million gallons of fuel daily. We will investigate the relationship between Russian intelligence and the criminal group DarkSide, who claim to be apolitical and only interested in money, but never engage in attacks against Russian targets. Then finally, we'll examine how the Republican Party is becoming more and more like Putin's rubber stamp party, United Russia, as the GOP falls in behind Trump as their dear leader and embraces the big lie while pulling out all the stops to cheat in the next elections. Michael Hodorowski, a professor of history at Loyola University Chicago, who is a frequent contributor to the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, and is the author of Russia's 20th Century, A Journey in 100 Histories, joins us to discuss how Putin's propaganda machine and Trump's are alike, and together they are dividing America and turning Americans against each other. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org, as either the Pacifica Network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now from Israel is Gideon Levy, who's an Israeli journalist and columnist for Haaretz and a member of the newspaper's editorial board. He's the former spokesman for Shimon Peres and writes the weekly Twilight Zone feature, which covers the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza for over the last 30 years. And his latest book is The Punishment of Gaza. And he has an article at Haaretz, A Totally Right-Wing Government. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gideon Levy.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us, Gideon. And I take it that rockets have been fired from Gaza in response to the injuries of, what, about 300 Palestinians in these ongoing struggles over the Al-Aqsa Mosque, where apparently a number of Palestinians have spent the night protecting, well, I guess it's considered the third holiest shrine in Islam. But prior to that, there have been clashes over the possibility of sections of East Jerusalem being taken over by settlers. And there is, of course, the Jerusalem Day March, right, celebrating the Israeli victory in 1967 in Jerusalem. So has the Jerusalem Day March, which has always been seen by the Palestinians as being very provocative, since it goes through the Palestinian sections of East Jerusalem, has that been cancelled?
Yeah, it was finally cancelled, but after a long and violent day and a very tense day, finally it was cancelled.
So, and what about the sections of Shiraz Jirah district in East Jerusalem and the possibility of the evictions of Palestinian families there? Have the Supreme Court, they were going to rule on that, but I take it they postponed that decision?
Absolutely. They postponed it because of the situation, according to the request of the government.
I see. So is this still escalating, or can it be turned down? If the government is obviously trying to calm things down, if they've got the Supreme Court to postpone the decision, what's happening at the national level in terms of the leadership?
What the government is doing is too little and too late. Let us not forget that Israel had bombed Gaza this afternoon and killed at least 3 children. So whatever the government is doing now to calm down is really too little and too late. You have to see the overall picture. And the overall picture is that East Jerusalem, Palestinian Jerusalem, is occupied in a very, very brutal way for, as you know, 53 years now. And in recent weeks, Israel did anything possible to make this explosive region even more explosive. There were some really outrageous decisions of the Israeli police and the government, which provoked the Palestinians and pushed them more and more to the wall. And above all, obviously, the issue of Sheikh Jarrah, which you just mentioned, which is really unbelievable, because the few Jews who lost their properties in 48, according to the Israeli law, have the right to get it back, while millions of Palestinians who lost their properties in 48 can only dream about it. Tell me what it is if not apartheid. I mean, how else can you call it?
But what is happening between the Israeli government and these young nationalists who march through East Jerusalem shouting death to Arabs? Are the police in complicity? Is the government in complicity? Is there any way to rein them in?
But again, look backwards. Look how many violence came from the settlers' circles, and how little did Israel do about it. It's almost on a daily basis that the settlers, Jewish settlers, are beating Palestinian peasants, are destroying their fields and their properties, and the Israeli police does nothing, but really nothing. So here it comes to a stage in which those bands, and they are bands, are trying to provoke the Palestinians on the day in which Israel occupied East Jerusalem. And the police and the government are supporting them, nothing but supporting them. Only when it comes really to an explosive stage, then the government decides to stop it. Why to stop it today? Why not? So many people say it. You have to prevent it. You have to prevent it. It will end up with a lot of bloodshed. Okay, so the government and the police didn't listen, and here we are.
And when you talk about the government, there's some doubt about who's running this government. I mean, isn't Netanyahu's days numbered?
It seems so, but this also can change the whole picture, because everything now is on hold because of this tension. Before it exploded, it seemed that in a very few days, maybe this week, there could be a new government to Israel.
And would it be that different, this new government under Benny Gantz?
No, it's not under Benny Gantz, it's under Naftali Bennett, and unfortunately it will not be any different.
So tell us about Bennett then.
Bennett is an orthodox, right-wing Israeli who comes from the circles of the settlers and betrayed Netanyahu, because he had this chance to become prime minister with a party of 6 seats out of 120. He might become prime minister for the first 2 years with 6 seats in the parliament. Imagine yourself. This guy doesn't have 10% of the voters, even not 7% of the voters. But Israeli system allows it, and he decided to go with the other camp, which is combined from an impossible coalition of right-wingers and central right-wingers and some leftist parties, all of them very small. And I'm not sure this will last, but what unites them all is the hatred toward Netanyahu.
Right, but why did the leftist parties abandon Benny Gantz?
No, Benny Gantz is lost already. He became a very small party in these elections, and he will be part of this coalition, but not as prime minister.
Mm-hmm. So in these sort of musical chairs, as they cobble together governments, the preponderance is always on the right, right? That's the point of the article that you just wrote, right? A totally right-wing Absolutely. Government?
Right. You must understand that the majority of the parliament and the majority of the Israelis are right-wingers. We can't help it.
Right. And that continues year in and year out, even though, relatively speaking, there hasn't been any, I mean, from the Palestinians, there hasn't been any great uprisings, no intifadas. Maybe that's what the government's now afraid of, that they could reach a tipping point there. So
I don't think they will reach it.
You think it'll be calmed down soon?
After a few days, until the next explosion. But this will not lead to an intifada, because the Palestinians are by far too weak and lacking unity and lacking leadership.
Well, I was going to say, they're lacking leadership. There's a complete vacuum, isn't there?
Absolutely.
It's like a government on autopilot.
Right.
So what then is the, from your point of view, do you get tired of feeling powerless? Is there a way out? Is it inexorable that the country moves further and further to the right?
Only if the United States and other countries will get involved, and involved in deeds, not in talkings, because with talkings, Israel learned that this leads us to nowhere, and Israel couldn't care less about American condemnations. It must be deeds, or nothing will change.
And what kind of deeds? I mean, obviously, the Israelis, right, had a perfect government in Trump and Jared Kushner, who was really just a stenographer for Netanyahu, with these Abraham's Accords, which were supposed to basically change the subject from the Israeli-Palestinian struggle to an Arab-Iranian struggle. And it's largely an arms deal, as far as I can tell. So clearly Biden is not popular, as Netanyahu was not popular. But what kind of deeds could they do in order to, you know, basically send a message to the Israeli right that they don't have a blank check?
It is much easier than you think. Remember how the world treated the apartheid system in South Africa and how efficient it was. And remember how depending is Israel on the United States. You just have to show Israel that there will be a price for violations of the international law, for violations of the resolutions of almost all international institutions. There must be a price. As long as there is no price tag, Israel can continue to do whatever it wants.
But what about external situations coming out of Syria and out of Iran? It's obvious that the Israeli government, whether it's Netanyahu or Bennett, are doing their best to sabotage any possibility of the United States resuming the JCPOA deal with Iran. One of the things that I find sort of curious is the recent rocket that landed about 30 kilometers from Dimona, the nuclear reactor in the Negev Desert. The Israeli government suggested it was an errant Syrian ground-to-air missile that went astray. But there's also some reporting that suggests that it was actually deliberately fired by Iranians from Syrian territory as a kind of warning and a way to say, you have obviously done sabotage at Natanz and we could respond. So what do you think happened there? That shows a certain level of pragmatism on the part of the Israeli government. They don't want an all-out war with Iran, surely. What's the strategy there, do you think?
I think the strategy is right now to try to sabotage any agreement. And I think the United States until now quite ignored it. And I think once the message will be clear from the United States to Israel, stop sabotaging our diplomatic efforts, Israel will have to stop.
And that message has to reach the Israeli people as well as the government, right?
The government, not the people. The people have no influence and know nothing about it.
Really?
It's all about the government.
Yeah, but maybe they should know something about it. I mean, you think that they don't really care what the Americans think? Surely the Israeli people care about the loss of support from Europe that's happened over the decades?
I don't see it happening. There is a loss of support in words, not loss of support in deeds.
Uh-huh.
Israel didn't pay any price for the occupation.
Neither
from Europe nor from the United States.
So it's just been at a rhetorical level?
Absolutely.
So is that to suggest then that trade sanctions, boycotts, would that get the attention of the Israeli government?
If you think that the Israelis will wake up one shiny morning and say, oh, the occupation is not so nice, let's put an end to it. So we are living in a dream. This will never happen. It didn't happen for the last 53 years. It will be only when Israelis will have to pay for the crimes and be punished for the crimes, individually and collectively. And then people start to ask themselves, does it worth it? Do we really want it? And then might come a change.
Well, what's always been curious about the attitude to the Palestinians and the continual sort of encroachment on and reducing their territory down is that there's never been a real end game announced by the right wing in the country. And obviously the two-state solution looks pretty dubious. Is there any way to force the right-wingers to basically announce what their end game is, which seems to be to get rid of all the Palestinians, and that's clearly not going to happen?
Let's not be sure that it's not going to happen. I mean, it's not very reasonable, but I wouldn't exclude it because things are changing. Israel is so strong. The Palestinians are so weak. Don't exclude a slow process which started by now. I mean, Israel is expelling Palestinians from their homes. Right now, it's on a very low scale, but nobody stops Israel. What you see in Sheikh Jarrah, is an example. Obviously, it's on a very small scale, but you know, when Israel can go on with it, Israel will go on with it.
And what would the end game be? Would everybody be driven into Jordan? I just don't see, you know, what kind of a vision they have apart from ultranationalism. But are they willing to basically purge the entire country of Palestinians? I mean, that I can't see the world sitting by and letting that happen, but maybe.
I really hope you're right. It's also enough to tyrannize their lives so much until they, part of them will live by its own. And this also is happening, again, on a small scale.
Right.
But if Israel will continue to keep Gaza as a huge cage, and the West Bank will live under this very, very violent and brutal occupation, you know, there are young people who want a different life.
Well, Gideon, not the most cheerful of conversations, but, you know, that's the reality, right?
Absolutely. Unfortunately so.
Well, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate it very much.
Thank you very much. Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
And again, I've been speaking with Gideon Levy, who's an Israeli journalist and columnist for Haaretz and a member of the newspaper's editorial board. He's the former spokesman for Shimon Peres and writes the twice-weekly Twilight Zone feature, which covers the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza for more than the last 30 years. And his latest book is The Punishment of Gaza. And he has an article at Haaretz, A Totally Right-Wing Government. And he joined us from Israel. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the ransomware cyber attack on the critical infrastructure of Colonial Pipeline, which supplies 100 million gallons of fuel daily to the East Coast. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Sean Lingus, who's a senior reporter at CyberScoop, covering the Department of Homeland Security in Congress. His reporting also has appeared in The Washington Post, The Economist, and the BBC, among other outlets. And he has an article at CyberScoop, Cyber Attacks Disrupt Colonial Pipeline, which transports 100 million gallons of fuel daily. Welcome to Background Briefing, Sean Lingus.
Thanks very much for having me, Ian.
Well, thanks for joining us. And this pipeline is obviously quite critical, since it supplies gasoline and diesel fuel from Texas all the way through Georgia. It's a Georgia-based company, all the way through to New Jersey and into the Northeast. And it is, I believe, it carries 2.5 million barrels a day, which is 45% of the East Coast supply of diesel, petrol, and jet fuel. So it is, by any definition, critical infrastructure. So it's been attacked. So is this a subnational attack or a national attack hiding behind subnational actors?
I think the available evidence indicates that it's a cyber criminal operation. I haven't seen any evidence at all to suggest that there was some sort of state sponsorship. In a briefing today at the White House podium, that's what Ann Neuberger, who's the deputy national security advisor for the White House for President Biden, she said that indeed it was a cyber criminal operation using the ransomware that's called DarkSide. Now, you can get into a discussion more broadly about the countries that where this activity occurs, and a lot of times it's in Eastern Europe and Russia, and there's more pressure to hold governments that allow this criminal activity to take place on their soil accountable. And that's actually something that President Biden himself mentioned later in the day today in his remarks. I think he reiterated that it's likely criminal activity, but he did say that countries like Russia host this kind of activity. They need to be held accountable and confronted about it.
So DarkSide have their own website, and they're more or less saying, well, we really didn't mean to shut this down. We just want money. They apparently tell their victims exactly what they've got. They even show them the data that they've stolen. And they basically try to sell themselves as being non-state actors that are purely interested in money. And they even have on their website, believe it or not, an ethics page where they say which organizations they won't attack. So that's pretty extraordinary, isn't it, Sean?
Well, yeah. So it's becoming more of a thing with ransomware gangs, where they try to curry some sort of sympathy with audiences, the public, even with journalists who write about them, to say that they have morals and boundaries. But we've seen repeatedly through the course of the pandemic that they don't really have those boundaries, whether it's attacking hospital computers at the height of the coronavirus, or now things like pipeline operators or other critical infrastructure. There were manufacturers in Italy that were recently in the first few months of the year shut down for a couple of days because of ransomware. So I'd never take any of these claims that they steer clear of certain targets seriously, because it's a criminal's word. As for the professional operations of the organization, that really is sort of the standard nowadays with high-end ransomware groups that go after big companies and try to get big payouts. They're run like a multinational enterprise, with a help desk, with a media department, and with specialists who are experts in hacking into systems and then handing off that access to other people. And they sell it as a service. It's It is remarkable, and it's been a sort of staple of the cybercriminal underground for a few years now, but it's really getting national attention, international attention, because of the things that they're attacking now. So I saw that note that was sort of like a half mea culpa, and I don't take it seriously. There's been some interesting analysis out there to suggest that it because of the as a service model that this group uses, that they're renting or they're leasing access, that one of their affiliates carried this out, and then the main group that is responsible for the organization saw that as going too far. I think that's a credible interpretation. I don't know if that is exactly what happened, but obviously they felt compelled to say something because now they've got U.S. law enforcement and other organizations that are going to want to hunt them down.
Right, but they provide ransomware information to these so-called affiliates who pay the dark side a percentage of their earnings from any successful attack. So they can't sort of claim that somehow, our hands are clean and oh, whoops, we didn't know.
Right, there's certainly culpability there.
Exactly. So again, I'm speaking with Sean Lingas, who's a senior reporter at CyberScoop covering the Department of Homeland Security and Congress. His reporting also has appeared in The Washington Post, The Economist, and the BBC, among other outlets. And he has an article at CyberScoop, Cyber Attack Disrupts Colonial Pipeline, which transports 100 million gallons of fuel daily. So what seems to have happened here, or at least made it easier for this penetration of Colonial Pipeline, is that because of COVID, a lot of their engineers are working remotely and therefore they're working from home. Is that the vulnerability here that we have in terms of our infrastructure in general in this country, Sean? Because it's our infrastructure is largely in private hands. And if you've got hundreds of computers, personal computers having access to the crown jewels, if you will, we're likely to have these problems, aren't we?
Well, right. The pandemic has exacerbated this with remote work. It's not as if everything is done remotely, but at least at the height of the pandemic in the United States, there were a lot of engineers at critical infrastructure companies, electric sector and many other sectors who, like all of us, had to work remotely. So there's more, anytime you're using a remote desktop protocol software to patch into work. That is a vector that could be susceptible to criminal hacking. So, in terms of the specifics around Colonial Pipeline, it will be really interesting to see the postmortem. I've seen from evidence out there that they did have some exposures in terms of unpatched systems that look like they there's a website called Shodan that has a sort of a registry of some of open, exposed software to the internet that might be exploitable. And I think that they have had some of that out there. And obviously, they're a huge company, extremely critical infrastructure. So they're going to be really in the limelight in terms of assessing what they did or didn't do to protect themselves from this sort of thing. And yes, the federal government is trying to help with all these resources after the fact. But again, after the fact is not going to continue to cut it for things like this when you have, a regional emergency declared to supplement the fuel that may or may not come because this pipeline's been shut down.
And we don't really know the full scope of the problem, do we? I mean, the Transportation Department has allowed vehicles, 18-wheelers, to bring in more fuel and easing some of the restrictions on how many hours the drivers can drive. But that doesn't sound like it's going to be adequate. Do we have a real handle on how much this cyber ransomware attack is interrupting the fuel supply to the east?
I don't think we have a clear picture of that yet. Obviously, it's consuming the highest levels of the government right now. President Biden said in his remarks today that he would consider other measures if necessary. So I guess I would stay tuned for that. Now, that the Colonial Pipeline said in a statement today that they aim to have, I believe, a majority of their systems back and running online by the end of the week. So it's a very fluid situation, and I think work, it's going to be affecting people at the pump potentially, and obviously that's an economic issue that all Americans can relate to. So I've never really seen a cybersecurity incident come into the mainstream at this level to really resonate with people, where it's something that everyone's talking about, from the president all the way down.
So, do we know exactly what happened? That these actors, whether they were the affiliates of the dark side or not, they hack into Colonial Pipeline and then they send a message saying, "We've seized all of your data, and you have to pay us what X millions of dollars." And presumably, whoever got that message in the company decided not to pay, and they tried to quickly do what they could to, prevent the destruction of all that data, and they were what partially successful, but essentially the ransomware attack went through and erased a lot of data and screwed up their system.
Yeah, I mean, that's generally you have the sort of longer it goes on, the less likely a victim is to pay. Now, I don't know if Colonial has paid. They haven't responded to my questions on that. And today, when the White House official Anne Neuberger was asked at the podium whether Colonial paid a ransom, she referred to the company, so she declined to comment. It looks like what happened, the attack began on Thursday, the infiltration of Colonial's IT systems, according to some reporting from Bloomberg. And the attackers, according to this reporting, were able to steal a large amount of data exfiltrated from the network. And that is obviously they're trying to use that as added leverage to extort the company. So I'm going to guess that it was a vulnerability in the software that they exploited. Some of my reporting on this group's tactics, they don't tend, I mean, I think they've sometimes have used phishing emails and sometimes not. If you give me a second to pull up what I had on that, I can tell you that, I mean, they're relatively new. People have been tracking them since August, and the FBI has been investigating since October. According to one analyst, I'm looking at my notes right now, the group tends to gain access to targets using stolen credentials, meaning login information that the victim has, or exploiting vulnerabilities, rather than phishing attacks. So, if history is a guide, that may have been one way that they got in, using stolen credentials or exploiting a known vulnerability. But again, I haven't seen the forensics, and I don't know if we will anytime soon. The focus right now, as you mentioned, was just on reassuring the fuel supply is stable. And again, the importance of this issue is hard to overstate, because you have a company that's privately held, and it's U.S. national security that they're sort of in charge of. When you think about it, it's they're operating critical infrastructure that millions of Americans rely on every day. So this is,
Right.
I hate to use the phrase wake-up call, but this is certainly a turning point.
Right, and it obviously means that there has to be more in terms of a private, public, or private and government partnership here to harden this critical infrastructure against these kind of attacks, because this is just the first shot across the bow. But my understanding is that there's a sort of tacit agreement. If we get attacked on our critical infrastructure, that's a red line. The SolarWinds attack, this is like the third major attack, as you point out in your article, Sean. You've had SolarWinds, and then you've had the Microsoft Exchange Servers attack as well. So this is the third one. Now, my understanding is that there's a power struggle going on inside Russia, where Nikolai Petrushev, who's a national security advisor, a real hardliner, in charge of the FSB. We know that the Russian state works with criminals. They use oligarchs as cutouts to funnel money abroad for their active measures campaigns, but they also use criminals as well. And it's hard to know where the criminality ends and where the intelligence professionals begin. There's kind of a merger going on there. But one of the theories is that Petrushev, who's challenging Putin from the right, if you think Putin is bad, this guy's a hell of a lot worse. He's trying to sabotage Putin's upcoming summit with Biden. And it's certainly puts a lot more pressure on Biden, doesn't it? I mean, obviously, nobody's saying that this is a state-sponsored attack, but knowing the way that Russian intelligence works, particularly with this hardliner in charge of so much of Russian intelligence, I mean, they really do have a relationship, shall we say, with criminals, as they do with their oligarchs. And we simply don't know. We know that the dark side is largely in Russia. They've never attacked any Russian targets, even though they say they're only interested in making money. So do you think there'll be more clarity on this at some point?
Well, you raised some interesting points. I mean, I don't know if there's ever going to be any sort of evidence that surfaces of some sort. I mean, it looks, everything I've seen points to cyber criminal involvement and not state involvement. But again, I don't have a security clearance, so I'm not privy to every piece of data. But I mean, more broadly, just commenting on the broader issues that you raised, I think, you know, it is fascinating to examine some of the evidence over the years that has come up of Russian government sort of collaboration with cyber criminals. Obviously, I'm not talking about the dark side case, because again, that just seems to be a criminal operation. But generally speaking, there is quite a bit of overlap sometimes, according to indictments and other forensic data that have been made public. The U.S. Treasury Department last month accused the ransomware game, a gang called Evil Core, of collaborating with the FSB. And that was long rumored, but never really publicly stated that I know of by a U.S. government entity. And, you know, there's other anecdotes over the years of how the FSB, the GRU, and the SVR kind of dipped their hands into recruiting from Russia's cyber criminal class. So I think that's a subject that is worthy of an entire separate episode. And I think it's something that we in the media and will continue to examine, obviously.
Well, Sean, I thank you very much for joining us. I appreciate it very much.
Yes, thanks for having me. Always a pleasure.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Sean Lingus, who's a senior reporter at CyberScoop covering the Department of Homeland Security in Congress. His reporting also has appeared in The Washington Post, The Economist, and the BBC, among other outlets. And he has an article at CyberScoop, Cyber Attack Disrupts Colonial Pipeline, which transports 100 million gallons of fuel daily. We're going to take a brief station break and back examining how the Republican Party is becoming more and more like Putin's rubber stamp party, United Russia, as the GOP falls in behind Trump as their dear leader and embraces the big lie while pulling out all the stops to cheat in the next elections. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Michael Hodakovsky, who is a professor of history at Loyola University Chicago and the author of several books, including Bitter Choices, Loyalty and Betrayal in the Russian Conquest of the North Caucasus. He is also a frequent contributor to the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, and his latest book is Russia's 20th Century, A Journey in 100 Histories. Welcome to Background Briefing, Michael Hodakovsky.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be here.
Well, thanks for joining us. And I'm speaking to you in the sense that a really successful Republican strategist, Matthew Dowd, who was a chief strategist for George W. Bush's 2004 winning campaign and also for Arnold Schwarzenegger's winning campaign out here in California, he's now making an awful lot of sense. And he's obviously incredibly disturbed about how American democracy is going off the rails, largely led by Donald Trump and this Stop the Steal lie, where you've got 7 out of 10 Republicans believing that Trump won the election, that Biden is illegitimate, and that the people that stormed the Capitol were hugging and kissing the police, and the violence that happened on January the 6th was perpetrated by Antifa. So he's basically arguing now that we have to, that in fact Biden should make this his number one priority, that what we're fighting for here in the United States is for American democracy itself and writ large democracy around the world, which is under attack from people like Xi Jinping in China and Vladimir Putin in Russia. So what I see in this de-evolution of American democracy is the influence of Russia. They're not responsible for the divisions in this country, and I don't know how much they're responsible for Trump. They may be more responsible, and we may learn more about that later. But the long and the short of it is, having studied Russia and Russian media, do you see a similarity here with how Putin, through his so-called political technologist Surkov, came up with this media landscape that they have in Russia, where the Russian people are just manipulated into the situation where you don't know what to believe and you just sort of give up on politics? And they have a party, United Russia, which is, unfortunately, the Republican Party is looking more and more like United Russia, where you have the vestiges of democracy, but the elections are all rigged.
Right. Well, let me just say this first, that, you know, whatever Putin does now and whatever Russia represents now, there's really nothing fundamentally new. In many ways, it's simply a continuation of the Soviet Union and Soviet policies. In fact, they are moving back more and more towards kind of a more classic image of the Soviet Union. And as you know, disinformation was a huge part of the Soviet propaganda war, propaganda activity, part of the intelligence sort of intelligence activity. So it just, they're using this in a different way and using different means to do the same thing. And that is, you try to keep your enemy, and the United States is the arch enemy at this point. You keep your enemy off balance. You throw all kind of information at them so they don't know what is true, what is not. So in many ways, it's really nothing new. Whether it's technologies, military technologies, from what I read, these are all refurbished Soviet technologies from the 80s before the Soviet Union collapsed. But there's really nothing new that Russia can invent at this point. That's the tragedy of today's Russia. It, unlike China, it has very little to offer to the world except for natural resources. There's just nothing that's coming out of Russia these days. In fact, I just read that last year reached the largest number of a brain drain from Russia. 70,000 top scientists and scholars left Russia, and that's the largest number since Russia, the new Russia, was born in 1991. So that's one thing. Another thing I would say, that as you noted correctly, the Russians did not invent the divisions in the U.S. We were always a very divided country. But there were themes and there were issues that united us. And, of course, the Cold War was one of them, where both Republicans and Democrats understood that, you know, whatever the different visions of social issues or political issues, we need to come together on certain points. But I like to quote this Russian head of he was the head of a very famous in the Soviet Union, a U.S.-Canada Institute. Georgi Arbatov was his name. He was sort of the top Soviet expert on the U.S. And I believe it was 1988 when he and Gorbachev were in New York. And at some point, Arbatov commented to his American counterparts, and he said, "We're going to do something really terrible to you. We're going to deprive you of an enemy." And, you know, it was, whether he meant it as a joke or he really understood actually rather profound truth behind it, it is true. Once the Soviet Union collapsed, once we began to understand that, okay, the Cold War is over, we won it, there is just very little that unites the country on a certain, at least in the among the political elites. And so these divisions of course, became more and more pronounced. And Trump, of course, is the worst manipulator of these divisions, acting sometimes when you know how the Russians operate and what Trump was doing. You just wonder whether he received tips from, you know, FSB, this Soviet security intelligence agencies. Most likely not. It's just the patterns in which these kind of manipulators and autocrats operate. But these divisions, I want to emphasize, are our divisions. But what the Russians are doing is they, of course, manipulating and exacerbating it by all means possible, and we're still struggling to sort of understand how to react to it, how to counter it effectively.
Well, but is that to say that the most success that Russia's had or Putin's had against the main enemy, which is how the KGB used to refer to the United States during the Cold War, and I believe that is Putin's mindset. In many ways, he seems to be more obsessed with trying to bring America down than bringing Russia up, because he's stealing the country blind. So, and you mentioned the enormous brain drain that's happening, and the young people are totally disenchanted with Putin. So is this media landscape that we have borrowed from the Russians, or at least Fox News and others have borrowed, it seems to be working for him. That may be his most successful export, if Trump himself is not his most successful export.
Well, first of all, I don't know whether Fox News was a result of borrowed from Russia. I think it's the other way around. The Russians, Surkov, among them you included, and many others, borrowed various Western media technologies and then applied it to the Russian landscape. But you know, I want to emphasize sort of a larger point here. We are focused on Russia's sort of nefarious, malicious activity, as we should be. But on the long run, Putin is losing. He is losing in many different ways. Look at Ukraine. The issue of Ukraine, that's from 2014. That's 7 years now. Ukraine is further away from what he wanted to do. It is, it's inconceivable now that Ukraine could become part of some kind of a greater Russia or whatever Eurasian empire, which in whichever way he wants to reconstitute parts of the Soviet Union. If you look at the situation in Russia, all this cyber activity, all this military modernization of the military, all of this comes at enormous price. The poverty level is estimated, and this was recently an article written by Mr. Deribaska, who is one of the billionaires, and he wrote this article and then was quickly forced to withdraw it. But he said that the poverty level in Russia is actually three times higher than the official government number suggests, so there's around 60%. The prices are rising. In the last couple of months, the food prices on food rose 15%. There is a great dissatisfaction because the standard of living is dropping. COVID, of course, was a disaster. The sort of objective estimate, more or less, of the number of dead from COVID in Russia is about four or five times, at least, higher than the Russian official number. That is around 500,000. So it's really a disaster on many fronts, you see it in which in what the government is doing now. They're just cracking down. They ran out of ways of kind of providing people with some kind of incentive or future vision. There is just no vision anymore. It's totally bankrupt. It's a complete dead end. So as great as a Putin, and some people think of him as a geopolitical player, it is absolutely not true. He's in a complete geopolitical dead end right now. And so all these successes, yes, but Russia, as I recently pointed out in one of the op-eds I wrote, Russia is simply not competitive among modern states. It wants to believe that the world still rests on three whales, which is U.S., China, and Russia. But Russian economy is 2%, 2 to 3%, I believe, of world GDP. United States is 25%. Russia's population is just a little more than that of Japan. And look at the population of Japan living on these small islands and enormous territory of Russia. Demographically, they are in terrible decline that is unstoppable at this point. Besides various ways they try to encourage the having more children and so on. So it cannot really develop all the territories that it occupies. So it is quite a disastrous situation. And the only way they know to react to it is just tightening the screws by putting the opposition members, there's no official opposition, but those who criticize them in jail and harassing everyone else. And that's, that's my vision of, sure. of Putin's Russia.
Well, when I made the analogies between Putin's party, United Russia, and the Republican Party, I think it's clear from what you've told us that United Russia and Putin, and they're losing power in Russia. They're on the way out, I suppose. But conversely, the American model, following this Putin model, which is the Trump GOP, would seem to be on the rise, at least in terms of Trump's power. And it is exactly heading in the same direction as United Russia and Russia, in a sense that we're going to have rigged elections. That everything that Trump and the GOP are doing now is about not competing, but cheating. They've given up on trying to compete with the Democrats. They've decided to cheat. And that they're going to rig the election and they're going to lie, which are the two tools that Putin uses, rigging and lying. And it's happening here before our eyes. Everything that's coming out of Kevin McCarthy's mouth, the fact that they're firing Liz Cheney is an example of what I'm trying to suggest here, Michael. And that's the mirror that I see. I mean, obviously, Russia doesn't have a GDP. It's less than Canada next door. So that's points well taken. But in terms of the dark mirror between the two countries, it seems to me that the Republican Party today is a kind of totalitarian Stalinist type of party where you basically have to fall in line behind the chairman, and if you criticize anything, you get purged. And I find it just extraordinary that that's happening before our eyes. And again, it takes a Republican like Matthew Dowd to tell the Democrats it's time to wake up and defend democracy itself.
Yeah. Well, by the way, Russia's GDP is smaller than that of the state of New York, if you really want a very vivid comparison of how disproportionate its ambitions are to what Russia really is. Well, you want to move me into the realm of American politics, Ian, and I'm happy to say a few things, but, you know, I'm a Russia expert, not a U.S. one. There are clearly some comparisons in the sense that, as you described correctly, they Republicans trying to tighten in the voting rules, as we know, and limit the opportunities for other people to vote and so on. But I wouldn't go that far yet, because after all, we do have democratic institutions which proved squeaking and creaking. It proved that during the Trump years, they worked. I mean, wherever the Republicans tried to bring the case to the Supreme Court or any court about a false count of election results in whatever state, all of them were rejected. There's nothing of the sort in Russia. There are no courts, no independent courts. There's no independent media practically left. there is no parliament, functioning parliament. This is a rubber stamp parliament. as Russians like to joke, they say, yeah, we also have an opposition, but it's in jail. So it's a completely different landscape. And I don't want to diminish the danger of what Republicans are up to and the way they behave and where they move in the country. And I wouldn't even call them Republicans anymore. It's a Trump party, so they're Trumpists, because Republican has a different meaning from the old days. But at least we still live in a functioning democracy where people indeed divided, and people can organize in a divided way, but they can organize and have legitimate oppositions. No one is being executed or put in jail or poisoned the way they do it in Russia. So it's a quite different situation, I would say.
Until the Trump party takes over.
Well, I don't think they'll arrest you or me for criticizing them. That's the difference. That's a big difference. You know, we still live in a free society, but you know, it's a complicated society, which is, you know, I think the analogy that I turn myself constantly, I look at, is a late Roman Empire. I read more in the Roman Empire and see why and how it collapsed. And then there are some interesting parallels there, which are rather alarming. But I just hope we won't reach that point. But who knows? Who knows?
Well, Michael Hodorowski, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Michael Hodorowski, who is a professor of history at Loyola University Chicago and the author of several books, including Bitter Choices, Loyalty and Betrayal in the Russian Conquest of the North Caucasus. He is also a frequent contributor to the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times. And his latest book is Russia's 20th Century, A Journey in 100 Histories. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right, another headline.